Solitaire Rose Radio, Episode 36, Jack Kirby's Final Marvel Stint, 1975 to 1979. Nearing the end of the Jack Kirby series that I've done, and this one holds a special place in my heart because this is where I started buying comics. When I left off in the last episode, Jack Kirby had decided that he would go back to Marvel. He had signed a contract with Marvel. He had put into the contract certain things that he wanted, one of which was to be a writer, editor, artist, that he would be editing his own work, which was something that Marvel only allowed a few people to do. Usually it was former editors-in-chief like Roy Thomas or Len Wein, Marv Wolfman. Steve Gerber had it for a short time. Most people worked with other editors. However, Marvel's editorial system in the 70s was fairly chaotic. Kirby put together a deal much like the one he thought he had put together at DC, where he would package the books, finish them all up except the coloring and some editorial. They would take care of the letters pages actually in New York. He would not put together the letters pages for his Marvel work. And it was announced at a New York City comic convention. Stan Lee announced it quite proudly and loudly that Kirby was coming back. And I started buying comics the spring of 1975. I'd always read comics. I'd always read kids' comics, mostly. I didn't much care for superhero comics or horror comics or any comics like that. I liked the art style in the kids' comics because it was, it didn't scare me. I've talked in the past. I was a very, very sensitive child. I got scared very easily, and when I got scared, it kind of freaked out about it. I look back on it now, and it's like near panic attacks I would have when I would see something scary on TV or read something scary. At that age, I wasn't equipped for it. But I was riding the school bus with a couple of kids who were comic book fans, and they were going on and on about how Marvel's comics were the best comics, and they're the only comics you should read. And I was indoctrinated into that world of the Marvel zombie, as it's been referred to many times, as people who only read Marvel. And the fact that, you know, there was so much peer pressure that don't read DC. DC are dumb comics, defective comics. You don't read them. You read Marvel. Marvel are the only good comics. College students read Marvel comics. And, you know, when you're a kid and you go, oh, comic? These are comics written by college students? Wow, they must be really smart. Then, of course, when I was a college student, I realized, no, college students are just as dopey as everybody else. But as I'm picking up, first few months, I didn't know the difference between a reprint and an original comic. So I still remember being told that Spider-Man was such a big deal because they'd killed his girlfriend. The Green Goblin had killed his girlfriend, and then the Green Goblin was killed, and it was a big deal. And I picked up a Spider-Man comic, and right there, Gwen Stacy was in the comic. I didn't know it was a reprint from the 60s. But I saw Gwen Stacy in the comic. And the kid who was a friend of mine on the bus was, well, I read the comic where she died, and I have a subscription, and she's still dead. And I brought in the comic and showed him. And he finally said, oh, do you see right here? This little box here, this originally presented in Amazing Spider-Man, blah, blah, blah. That means it's a reprint. And in 75, Marvel was just pumping out reprints like you can't believe. There were tons of them. Because they had achieved the number one selling comic company. They'd unseated DC. Dell had faded. Harvey never really was a huge seller. It did okay. Carlton was kind of the bargain basement. Gold Key, which had been Dell, in a very weird way, had really sort of faded over time as TV captured more and more kids. They didn't need to read a comic to be entertained. They could watch stuff on TV. And comic distribution wasn't going that well. I remember you'd pick up a comic, and I would actually look at the back, and if it was continued, I'd put it back because I had no idea if I could get the next part unless it was drawn by Jack Kirby, because the Jack Kirby books were like, oh. And then in the bullpen bulletins, they did a big thing about how Kirby is back, the king is back, and I didn't know he'd been gone. And they did a bunch of hype leading up to him coming in. Tons of hype. And it almost felt like, when I look back on it now, they really felt Kirby's back. Stan had kind of stepped away. But Kirby was one of the mainstays. They could get that feel of the 60s books again. Most of the writers and people who were in editorial had been big fans of Marvel in the 60s, and they wanted to be there. They wanted to be part of it. And when Kirby came in, they really kind of made a big deal of it. And I know we look back on it now, and his Marvel tenure was not as successful as everyone thought it would be. But Jack said in interviews that he really felt like, you know, he came crawling back, and they didn't really support him. And we'll talk about that a little. But I think at the very beginning, they were huge on Kirby. I mean, as a kid, I remembered the ads. And the thing was, he still had books coming out from DC when his first two pieces of Marvel work showed up. It was the summer of 1975, so it was quarterly books, one of which was Conan the Barbarian, the giant-sized Conan. He did the cover for that, and then he did the cover for Marvel Treasury Edition, did the back, the front and back covers. And he still had books coming out at DC, because DC was so far ahead, and Marvel was notoriously late with things, that he still had a bunch of stuff coming out from DC. If you look at the Kirby timeline, June of 1975, Commandy number 30 came out. There were going to be 10 more issues of Commandy, and Marvel was already printing stuff by Kirby, mostly covers. But when you look, by November of 1975, Kirby returned to the Fantastic Four with covers. He did the cover for Fantastic Four number 164. He did the cover for Invaders number 3, Iron Man number 80, Jungle Action number 18, Kazar number 12, Marvel Premier number 26, Marvel Superheroes, which was a reprint book, number 54, Marvel 2-in-1 number 12, Thor 241, and that was when Commandy number 35 came out. And he had covers every month. In January of 1976, well, January cover date of 1976, you had Captain America 193. Kirby came back, and one of the books he did was Captain America. He did that as a monthly. 193 was his first issue. It was the Mad Bomb story. It was the beginning of his build-up to Captain America number 200, which would come out in July of 1976. So Cap's bicentennial issue came out in the bicentennial month. But that same month, Commandy number 37, there were still three issues of Commandy that DC still had in the tank. If you look at the next month, Captain America 194, Cobra number 1, a series that he'd kind of co-created or helped out with for DC. First issue comes out. Commandy still coming out. And as Captain America came out, they really started to hype. Okay, Kirby's next book is going to be The Eternals. And they did teases in the bullpen bulletins and in ads and in some letters pages they teased it. They really were working hard to try and get people excited about it. Then if you look at the 1976 specials, which were books that kind of came out at any time during the year, Kirby did Captain America Annual number 3, He did covers for a bunch of annuals. He did probably one of the first graphic novels, if you want to look at it that way. He did a tabloid. They were called Treasuries. They were a tabloid side comic called Captain America's Bicentennial Battles. It was a huge comic. I think it was like 70, 80 pages, probably closer to 90 with all the pinups and everything. But it was Captain America through the years, and Kirby just did a huge story, and it was on the tabloid size, so it was almost the size of the original artwork. And it, for most of Kirby's stuff, he had his inkers back in California, but on this one, they had Barry Windsor Smith inking it, John Vierputin inking it. It was kind of okay, we're going to let everybody ink it. And part of it might have been to try and get it out, before the bicentennial. The other part of it might have been, hey, this is a big deal. Let's make each chapter look a little different. Kirby also, during this time, put out the Treasury Edition, his adaptation of 2001: A Space Odyssey. Which, if you think about it, it came out in 1976, which was 8 years after the movie. This was before VHS. This was before you could, go to the library and even watch it. You had to wait till it was either on TV, and I don't think it had been on TV yet, or re-released in theaters. Kirby did an adaptation of it. It was a very Kirby take on the movie. This was my first encounter with 2001: A Space Odyssey. It was one of those movies I'd heard about that was so brilliant and so well done and so amazing. I couldn't go see it. I couldn't see PG movies in 1976 because my parents just wouldn't take me till I was older. But also, I lived near the movie theater in Canton, Illinois. They had two theaters. They're certainly not going to be showing a re-release of 2001: A Space Odyssey. They didn't have repertory theaters. They didn't have theaters that showed older movies. They barely had enough time to get in the newer movies. And if a new movie was a hit, like Jaws, well, that meant that was the only movie playing in one of the theaters all summer long. So, 2001: A Space Odyssey, I'd heard about it and heard about it, and now Kirby's done this Treasury Edition. And comics were a quarter at the time, and the Treasury Editions were $1.50. And trying to talk your parents into letting you buy a comic book that's $1.50. My mom would go, well, you could buy six comics for that. And I go, no, want, Jack Kirby. And I honestly don't remember what I had to do to earn the money for it, but I remember it was at the Smithfield grocery store for, a few weeks. And every time I came in, I'd ask mom, she'd go, no, it costs too much. And I'd save up money and everything. And every time we went in, I'd go to the lady at the register and go, make sure nobody buys that comic. I want it. And I doubt they listened to me because I doubt anybody else wanted it. And when I bought it, I read it over and over and over and over and over. Same with the Captain America Bicentennial Battles. I read them over and over and over and over. Kirby's visuals on 2001 were just phenomenal. And I don't, they, from what I hear, they sent him very limited stills. Kirby had to do a lot of it from memory of seeing the movie. And there wasn't a lot of cooperation from MGM on it because the movie's 8 years old. And it was big and it was expressive and it had Kirby's own personal take on the ending, Kirby's own personal take on any of the scenes that were open to interpretation. And to this day, when I watch 2001: A Space Odyssey, I've read the novel that Arthur C. Clarke did. It was a co-production between Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, where they worked on the idea together. Kubrick wrote the screenplay, Arthur C. Clarke wrote the book, and in some ways they didn't agree. And it shows now that I'm older and understand more about things. But when I watch 2001: A Space Odyssey, I'm actually seeing it through the lens of Jack Kirby because that was my first encounter with that movie. Kirby's vision, Kirby's version on the page. And like a lot of the stuff Kirby did in the 70s, he was reaching further than comics had done. He was wanting to do things that were bigger, that were different, that were more than just disposable comics you read and then you pass them on or you throw them away. He didn't want to do disposable stories anymore. He wanted to do big stuff that mattered, that got ideas across. And then in July of 1976, well, that's cover date July of 1976, so that was probably more like May. That's when Eternals number one started. Eternals number one was another version of Kirby doing a civilization that existed alongside man but didn't interact with man until the story started. There were elements of the New Gods in it, to be honest. Most of the Eternals, he said that they had interacted with man in the past, and man had thought that they were gods. So a lot of them had similarities to the Greek and the Roman gods. It tied in with Eric Von Daniken's stuff, which was very, very popular. That a lot of Eric Von Daniken was the writer of the book Chariots of the Gods, where he looked at like cave drawings and other things done by humans, mostly in North and South America before European civilization came in, that and even other things where he said ancient astronauts, aliens visited Earth and imparted wisdom onto humanity and maybe experimented a little on humanity, but they interacted with humanity. And, Von Daniken was, you could read up on him. Von Daniken was a crackpot. He was a hotel owner who kind of came up with this theory without any proof, except looking at pictures and kind of saying, hey, could that be the drawing of a man in a spaceship? Why would there be things on the ground that you could only see from up high? Maybe they're landing strips for the UFOs. UFOs were really big in the 70s. The current thinking is that Von Daniken, as a hotel owner, his hotels weren't doing that well. He wanted to create an amusement park about aliens, and this was a book to kind of raise money and publicize it. Whatever it is, Chariots of the Gods was big. It was a big book, and a lot of people really fell into it. And Kirby, who was always looking for what was interesting and new and hot and all, kind of did his version of it with these characters and created beings called the Celestials, who were cosmic beings so powerful that we didn't quite understand them, but they had created these races. They created humans, Eternals, and the ones that were messed up were called Deviants. And the Eternals and the Deviants have been at war with humanity, kind of as the dopey thing in the middle. And the Celestials had now come back to judge their creation. And if humanity and did not succeed, they would wipe civilization from the earth. And that was kind of the main gist of the Eternals. When I read it now, there are echoes of the New Gods, and while he didn't have the complexity of the New Gods, he didn't have the high drama of the New Gods, there was still that idea of forces beyond mankind using Earth and mankind as their battlefield, with the fate of humanity in the balance. This is the series that Kirby did his creation at Marvel that lasted the longest. It lasted 19 issues in an annual. There was around issue 14, Kirby had Hulk show up, but because Kirby didn't really want to interact with the rest of the quote Marvel Universe unquote, he didn't have the actual Hulk. It was a cosmic powered Hulk robot. And one of the things that a lot of people at Marvel kind of resented was that Kirby didn't want to interact. He didn't want to do crossovers. Marvel was very big on continuity and crossovers and characters from other books appearing in each other's books. Kirby kind of wanted everything to be on his own, so he didn't have to interact with Marvel editorial that much. To the point where, when Kirby did come back, Roy Thomas, who was the writer-editor on the Fantastic Four, came to him and said, I would love it if you would come back to the Fantastic Four. I think it would be great. I think it would be a huge seller. I think it would really help your other books because you did so, you know, you did so much and so well and made the Fantastic Four such a big seller. You, a triumphant return. It's going to be great. And Kirby, who was still upset over what had happened in the 60s, where he felt he didn't get enough credit, told Roy Thomas the only way he would do it is if Roy wrote full script that Kirby would just draw. He wouldn't interpret, he would just draw what was on the script. He didn't want to do the, quote, Marvel method, unquote, where the writer gives the artist the plot. The artist goes and does the pacing and kind of has free rein to draw the story as he wishes, turns it back in, and the writer dialogues it. Kirby did not want to use that anymore. He just, if he was going to, he laid down the law that if he was going to draw a book that someone else wrote, they would have to do full script. And nobody at Marvel was doing full script. Nobody wanted to do full script. And there were a lot of people at Marvel who said that Kirby said that and demanded that, kind of so that he wouldn't have to work with other people. But the Eternals came out, and the Eternals got a huge, huge push. And Eternals was a monthly book. Captain America was a monthly book. It's one of those things where when Kirby was at DC, the New Gods, Mr. Miracle, Forever People were all bi-monthly books. At Marvel, they wanted their books monthly. They didn't really go for bi-monthly, even though a lot of things were that if a comic started at Marvel, it would be bi-monthly until the sales got to a certain point, and then it would go monthly. And the reason they would start a book at bi-monthly is they felt if it's on the stands for 2 months, more people will have a chance to pick it up. This was at the time when the all-new, all-different X-Men was bi-monthly. So Kirby's Eternals being a monthly book was a huge leap of faith for them. His Captain America had been monthly, it had been around, so it being monthly didn't change much. And then in July of 1970, in June of 76, Captain America number 200 came out. It's hard for us to imagine, but this was the culmination of the story Kirby had started in Captain America 193, but it was just a regular size comic. It wasn't double size, it wasn't extra size, it was just, you know, and I bought this comic because Captain America number 200 during the bicentennial, it was on the stands on Bicentennial Day, July 4th, 1976, and the whole Mad Bomb saga was Captain America versus a group of people who wanted to restore British rule to the United States, which I remember at the time fans were kind of, that's kind of stupid. Because Captain America had been in kind of the forefront of the social relevance movement in comics, where the plots had to do with what was going on in the news, to the point where in 1974, the main bad guy in the Secret Empire kind of was Richard Nixon. And then Kirby comes in with this story, which when you go back and you read it now, it's just, it's action, it's all these wonderful ideas, it's Kirby throwing out stuff page after page, and really kind of hearkening back to, all right, this, we're going to celebrate the bicentennial by really kind of going back to the first conflict America had as a country with the British, but with a big science fiction twist. There were other stories. I remember Captain America's love affair. Kirby did a love comic in Captain America. And when I read it now, knowing the context of Kirby's romance stuff, it's a wonderful homage to the stuff he used to do with enough superhero stuff and action that it fits as a Marvel superhero comic. But at the time, people were like, well, what happened to the girlfriend he used to have? Is he cheating on her? What's going on? And at the time, continuity was so important at Marvel. And they'd really kind of built their house on it. Kirby didn't much care about what had come before. He was always about telling new stories. He really didn't care about what other people had done when he wasn't on the book. He wanted to tell his stories. And that's why I think his Captain America stories, which have been collected numerous times now in trade paperbacks and hardcovers and even in an omnibus, they're timeless. You don't need to read anything else. You could just read those, and they're filled with Kirby action, and he's got all these ideas and characters that Marvel has strip-mined again, bringing them back. Arnim Zola. They've even used Mad Bomb a few times. They've used Dimension Z recently. Nothing Kirby did at Marvel during his second tenure has kind of been left alone. And you can't say that for a lot of comics Marvel did in the 70s. There are a whole bunch of one-shot villains and one-shot ideas that you're never going to see again unless somebody wants to make fun of it. I'm talking to you, Rocket Racer and Big Wheel. So, by the middle of 76, Kirby was still doing a ton of covers. He had two monthly books coming out. And the next series that he did for Marvel was, believe it or not, a series based on 2001 A Space Odyssey. And that came out toward the latter part of 1976. So there in the latter part of 1976, Kirby had Captain America, he had the Eternals, he was still doing covers, and he had 2001 A Space Odyssey. 2001 A Space Odyssey was a fascinating idea, but Kirby kind of got caught in a trap where he wanted to echo the movie's structure in each comic. And the way it was, there would be a section where we see something in ancient times. It could be cavemen, it could be Rome, it could be pre-Rome, it could be the Mesopotamians, it could be the Middle Ages. Then we would go forward to a future time that may have been around the same time as the movie 2001, but it was a future time. And the monolith, it was implied that the character in this modern time, the monolith had kind of given the character in the past an idea, a brainstorm, something to kind of move humanity forward a little bit. Then we go to the future, and it's implied that it's a descendant of this character in the beginning part of the story who's in some sort of situation that the monolith then shows up, does the same thing that was done in the movie, projects this character to become a space seed, a very, very highly evolved human, and would send this space seed out to create life on other worlds. And the first few issues followed this. But eventually Kirby kind of got away from the formula more and more as he wanted to tell stories based in different time periods. He wanted to tell stories of Rome. He wanted to tell stories of Egypt. He wanted to tell stories in the future. He was able to bounce around in time. And more the monolith and the 2001 structure faded away. One of the things I always say about Kirby's stuff is, if you read the first 20 issues of the Fantastic Four, you can see the book growing and growing and growing, but by the time you get to issue 40, it's a completely different book. And Kirby and Lee had really moved it to a different level. So imagine if the Eternals or 2001 or any of the other books he had a chance to stay on them 3, 4, 5 years as he worked out the kinks, got an idea of what he wanted to do, and then just started growing. Kind of like how Commandy started as one idea and then the world exploded out from there. Kirby was probably going to be able to explore out these ideas. One of the things that also was happening around this time, by this time, you also had Captain America had gone over issue 200. The Eternals had been going for a while. And this is where Kirby started to get very irritated and upset with Marvel, because Marvel would print letters that were not praise. Marvel had kind of cultivated their letters pages to be more literate, people doing commentary on the books themselves. And one of the things that they did is, if they weren't getting the kind of letters they wanted, they would kind of write the letters they wanted to sort of let people know, hey, if you write letters like this, you'll get printed. And it's really hard to say what letters in the comics were real and what ones weren't. There were a number of writers who, in interviews, real writers at Marvel in the 70s, who've put in interviews where they would write letters to their own books to kind of promote the stuff they were doing. And the people who put the letters pages together may or may not have known, a lot of the people who put together the letters pages were what they called assistant editors, which were basically copy editors and proofreaders and stuff. Or they were, you know, people like Tony Isabella, who had a book or two and was an assistant editor and helped out in the office and put up the letters pages. But Kirby felt that Marvel was printing too many negative letters about his stuff. And that was a gripe. And it's hard to know if he complained about it at the time. I know in interviews through the 80s, he complained about it a lot. He pointed it out and he said that he felt Marvel's editorial staff was sabotaging him because he wouldn't work with them more. Because he felt that these writers who were in their 20s and had grown up on Marvel books all wanted to be Stan Lee. And Stan Lee worked with Jack Kirby, so they all wanted to work with Jack Kirby, according to Jack. Now, some of the writers, some of the people in editorial have said, of course I wanted to work with Jack. Roy Thomas has said repeatedly that he really wanted to work with Jack. He thought that he and Jack would have made a good team. There are some other writers who later became friends or business associates who said, of course I wanted to work with Jack, but I wanted to do it on his terms. But around this time, there were some negative letters in the letters pages, and Kirby's sales had not been the blockbuster that they expected. They, much like DC, thought that Kirby would come in and blow the roof off the place. But this was a Kirby who had been over at DC and had been devalued by DC. He had started with his own stuff and kind of been moved to almost kind of just a staff artist. They'd taken a lot of the luster off him. And while Marvel really pushed him to the moon, Marvel's audience expected stuff that tied in with everything else, and Kirby didn't do that. There was also another factor, a generational factor. And I've talked about this previously. When I was reading these books, I was in love. I was in love. Jack Kirby's imagination was blowing my mind, all the ideas he would throw out. He still had this wonderful sense of design where everything looked exciting and his science fiction stuff looked like something you'd never seen. And his art held the color of the time very well. It's hard for me to explain, but there were some artists whose work looked very bright. It held the color well. George Perez was an artist who, no matter what book he did, it was always really bright. The color just popped off his art. Sal Buscema, the color popped off his art. John Buscema, the color looked more muted. Don Heck, the color looked more muted. Dave Cockrum, his stuff, the color popped. And for me, that color popping off the page, I could still think of those Kirby covers that were just bright reds and bright blues and bright yellows and just bam, demanded that you look at them. And of course, everybody in a Kirby book was always in action. A lot of other comics, because Marvel had really become a very writerly company, there were a lot of comics that were people standing around talking. Kirby, people, even if they're standing around talking, stuff is happening. There's action, there's movement, there's emotion. Everything is heightened. It's bigger. I love this stuff, But a lot of my friends who were reading comics at the time didn't care for Kirby's art. His art looks weird. His art looks old. Everybody has square fingers. Everybody's feet are, you know, 10 feet apart. It just... And it was a change in what kids wanted with art. They liked the Perez. They liked the Buscema. I remember there were people who preferred Herb Trimpe to Kirby, and I would look at Trimpe and go, but he's just imitating Kirby. He's just imitating Kirby. And we would trade comics. That's how you got to read more comics. And I remember there were some comics where if there were comics that were in demand, like if I had an issue of the Avengers, I could get two Kirby comics for that. Or if I had an issue of Howard the Duck, I could get three of the, I could get an X-Men and two Kirby comics for that. And I learned how my love for Kirby was making it easier for me to get all of his stuff. There were a few, you know, there were some books that I followed. I always bought Amazing Spider-Man. I always bought the Fantastic Four. I always bought Thor. And I always bought whatever Kirby put out. As we got into 1977, he added another bi-monthly book, and that was Black Panther. This one really stuck in a lot of people's craws. Don McGregor had been doing Black Panther in Jungle Action, and his stuff was very mature. It was adult. It was aimed at adults. He was another guy who didn't play in the Marvel Universe. He would use the history of the Black Panther, but then he would do his own stories that wouldn't cross over into anything else. And Jungle Action had a huge vocal fan following, but its sales were not good enough to keep it going. It was one of those books where if Marvel would have had the direct market, it probably would have been a direct market only book and sold very well. But the Don McGregor stuff ended without the main story being finished, because he was in the middle of the Panther versus the Klan. And that story ended because sales weren't good enough and he didn't get enough time to finish the story, and was told he'd be able to finish the story in another book, like Marvel Premiere or something. Instead, he left Marvel. And Kirby's Black Panther came out, and Kirby paid no attention to what anybody else had done. His Black Panther was the king of Wakanda, who went on amazing adventures and did, you know, super scientific stuff. And Kirby liked the contrast of the African. This is a king in Africa who's going on super science fiction adventures. And I remember picking up the first issue, and I, of course, was a big Don McGregor fan. And for me, it was kind of like whiplash, going, wait a minute, what the hell? But by the second issue, Kirby had introduced all these cool science fiction ideas, and I was in. You know, it was like any other Kirby book. Oh yeah, I'm in. 2001 A Space Odyssey was actually a monthly book as well, which again surprises me. Black Panther, of course, was bi-monthly. So Kirby had, I think, what, January of 1977, he drew 79 pages. 79 pages in a month. In 77, he had 57 pages. I'm sorry, in February, he had 57 pages. In March, he had 79. In April, he had 60. In May, he had 75. So Kirby was doing four books, three monthly and one bi-monthly. He was still doing a lot of covers. He was doing Fantastic Four covers. He was doing Avengers covers. He was doing Invaders covers. He was doing Thor covers. You know, Thor and Fantastic Four and the Avengers were kind of books that he was known for. And they were putting Kirby covers on the books. And these were all books that I was buying anyway. So it's like, oh, cool, I get a Kirby cover and a cool story inside. It was great. So in 77, this is what Kirby was doing. He had a lot of stuff coming out. As you get later in the year, Kirby is doing fewer covers, mostly because he's doing more interior pages. He's still doing between 50 and 90 pages a month between the three-monthly books and the bi-monthly book. So the covers began to fade. He was only doing covers for his own stuff by the middle of 1977. And it's hard to know if it's because they didn't think the Kirby covers sold. I think it was more, hey, he's getting his pages in. I don't know exactly how many pages a month he was contracted for, but if you do the math, it looks like it was around 75 to 80 pages a month. So between the bi-monthly and the monthly stuff coming out, he was getting that. And if you think about it, there's no artist now who could do that many pages a month. None. Nobody. Nobody could even... Now, if an artist does a page a day, they're considered a speed demon. But Kirby was doing 3 pages a day if he worked every day, 4 pages a day if he took weekends off. Think about that. And these weren't layouts. They weren't the John Buscema layouts where he just kind of does layouts and gives it to the inker who does the rest of the stuff, knowing how John Buscema would do figures and stuff. Nope, these were full layouts. These were full penciled pages. Just amazing stuff. The man was a speed demon. By the end of 1977, however, Kirby was no longer on Captain America. His last issue of Captain America was number 214. It is unknown to me if Kirby was removed due to sales or if it was he was starting to slow down, because if you look, his output sort of drops somewhat until we get to 78, then there's a big project. But when you get into early 78, he's doing 40 pages a month. Let's see, in the March of 1978, he had one book come out, because 2001 A Space Odyssey ended with issue 10. The Eternals ended with issue 19. So really, at one point, the only book Kirby was doing was Black Panther. And he left Black Panther with issue 12. But then in spring of 78, he had two new series start. One was Devil Dinosaur, which was a story of a cave boy and his pet Tyrannosaurus Rex. Kirby has said that Marvel kind of came to him and said, we want a kid-friendly book. We're really getting into animation. We're selling stuff to animation. Can you come up with something that would sell for Saturday morning animation? And Devil Dinosaur was the book he did. It has echoes of Commandy without the intelligent animals. And it's funny how the book has resonated through the years. Devil Dinosaur has shown up in a lot of places. After the 9-issue run, though, you didn't see much of Devil Dinosaur until you got to, I think it was a series called Fallen Angels, which was an X-Men spinoff. And Moon Boy and Devil Dinosaur were in that. So, yeah, that was weird. Devil Dinosaur was actually one of the first books by Kirby that I didn't much care for, and I think it was because it was written for kids. The dinosaur fights and everything were great, but there wasn't that Kirby explosion of ideas. And you have to wonder if Captain America, The Eternals, and 2001 ending kind of felt like what happened at DC, where it's, okay, the books I came here to do, they're not selling, they're canceled. What do I do now? We're also near the end of Kirby's contract. You know, it was 75, 76, 77, 78. It was a 3-year contract. So we're in the last year of the contract at this point. So they had Devil Dinosaur. The other book they did was actually a spinoff of 2001 A Space Odyssey. The last 3 issues of 2001 A Space Odyssey were the story of Mr. Machine, which was an android. And it was all of these books, it was unclear if they were in the Marvel Universe or not. And Machine Man was the name of the book. They changed it from Mr. Machine to Machine Man. Both that and the Eternals. It was very unclear if these books were connected to the Marvel Universe or not. And I think that limited their sales among the fans at the time. And in the letters pages, they were very ambiguous as to whether this was the Marvel Universe or not. So, as we go into 1978, Kirby was doing Black Panther, Devil Dinosaur, and Machine Man. But also in 1978, Kirby's last great work came out. And I'm not discounting the Hunger Dogs. I thought the Hunger Dogs was good. But this was Kirby's sort of last great book. And that is the original graphic novel created by him and Stan Lee for Fireside Publishing. It was The Silver Surfer. This was a trade paperback. It was all original. It sold for $5.95 in bookstores. This was something that I was able to get for Christmas later that year because, hey, it's Kirby. I gotta have it. And it was one of those years where Mom and Dad asked, well, what do you want for Christmas? And this was the only thing I mentioned. It's the only thing I said. Well, don't you want? No, I want The Silver Surfer by Jack Kirby and Stan Lee. And it was a full graphic novel. It was inked by Joe Sinnott. Kirby spent a lot of time on it, which is probably why his page output dropped earlier in that year. At the time it was talked about as an original graphic novel, Stan has since said that it was a movie treatment because movie companies had come to him and said they wanted to do a Silver Surfer movie, but they wouldn't be able to fit in the Fantastic Four or any of that stuff. So Stan wrote the outline for a Silver Surfer movie, which actually got traction. I remember when I went to my first comic book convention in Chicago, Jim Shooter was there, and he announced a Silver Surfer movie would be out the next year. And he talked about seeing test footage of the flying surfboard. And I have heard that the test footage was actually shot. But this was Stan's treatment for the movie. And he gave it to Jack. Jack turned it into the story. Stan scripted it. It was done like the old Fantastic Four. And it's so good. It's more mature than the comics were at the time. It could still have passed the comics code, but it was more mature. There was just this perfect blend of Stan's sort of hyper-humanist optimist philosophy, Kirby's bombast, and Joe Sinnott's inks of Kirby have always been my favorite. He gives Kirby this shine. This sheen. He kind of sandpapers the rough edges without losing any of the power and the majesty and the bigness that Kirby would bring. It's Marvel has reprinted it a couple of times, and one of the things I find fascinating when I go back and I pick it up, because I still have my original copy, and then I have the reprint copy from the 90s when they were reprinting anything. It's copyright Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. It's not, you know, copyright Marvel or this or that. And it doesn't even say the Silver Surfer owned by Marvel Comics. It's copyright Stan Lee and Jack Kirby. I don't know how strong that copyright is. I don't know anything about the deal. I don't know that in publishing, legit publishing, not comic book publishing in the 70s, if you wrote something, it was copyrighted to you unless you signed the rights away to the publisher and you would sign specific rights. All right, you have the right of first publishing. You have the right of, you know, you can publish it this many times and then it reverts to me and I can take it to another publisher. Or you can publish it, but I still own it, sort of thing. this was legitimate book publishing. Fireside was a big publisher in the 70s. They had printed Origins Marvel Comics, Son of Origins. They'd also printed some DC collections like that. I think they did a Secret Origins book. I don't know. I wasn't a big DC person at the time. But this was a big deal. And it was a $5.95 softcover and hardcover. I've never seen the hardcover. Never seen the hardcover that was printed at the time. I've only seen the paperback. But there was a hardcover at the time that was available. And if you're looking for Kirby's work in this at his final stint at Marvel, find this book. It's the one reunion of Stan and Jack. It's the reunion of Jack and Joe Sinnott, except on covers. It's just an excellent, excellent read, and it really rewards reading it and rereading it with Kirby's art. And in many ways, this was Kirby's last hurrah at Marvel as well. Because if you look, he finishes up Black Panther, the last issue of that. Black Panther gets demoted from monthly to bi-monthly, while Devil Dinosaur and Machine Man are still monthly. His last issue of Black Panther is issue 12. Machine Man ends with issue 9. Devil Dinosaur ends with issue 9. The last cover Kirby does for a book that he did not draw was Fantastic Four number 200. And the last thing Kirby did, according to Kirby, was an issue of What If that they had pitched to him and he said he'd do to sort of fill out his contract in a lot of ways. And that was What If number 11, What If the Fantastic Four were the original Marvel bullpen? Which is a fun story. It's Jack doing a story where he, Stan Lee, Sol Brodsky, and Flo Steinberg get superpowers. And unlike the funky Flashman stuff that Kirby did when he was at DC, he writes Stan the way Stan is seen by fans. He writes himself. Of course, he's the thing. Roy Thomas had pitched the idea to him. Although in the pitch Roy Thomas did, he pitched himself as the Human Torch. When the pages came in, it was Sol Brodsky instead of Roy Thomas. Roy always kind of took that as a personal insult, which is a shame. Then again, if you read the Funky Flashman story and you see how he portrays Roy Thomas, there's this image of Jack Kirby in fans' minds that Jack was this big, gregarious guy who loved everybody. And the more you read, it's not true. Jack was human. He loved his fans. When kids would come over to, they'd find out where he lived and they'd come to his house, he'd invite them in, his wife would make Kool-Aid, they'd sit around and talk comics. He was very generous with younger artists. He would work with them, he would show them how to draw things, he'd draw sketches for people when they came by. He was very generous, really taught younger artists more about drawing, how he drew. But Jack could hold a grudge. Jack could get upset. And if you read his interviews from the 80s, now part of it was that the interviewers would goad him into saying such things because, you know, hey, Jack Kirby bitches about Stan Lee and bitches about Marvel and bitches about DC. Sells a lot better, especially if you're a magazine that kind of makes its mark on trashing mainstream books, than if it's, oh, Jack, you know, talks about his life and talks about his career and talks about stuff that he did that he's proud of. People wanted the tabloid. They wanted the tabloid stuff. The last books that Jack came out with from Marvel were December 1978. Jack did not re-sign with Marvel. He didn't sign with DC. He didn't sign with anyone. in many ways, this was the end of Jack Kirby's being a full-time comic book artist. He did, however, through connections like Mark Evanier and other people, move from Marvel to animation. Marvel had an animation studio at the time. They were doing a Fantastic Four cartoon. Jack did storyboards. He did layouts for other companies. He created characters. He threw ideas at them. There was one company. There were a couple of companies that hired Jack just to create ideas that they would then take to the networks and pitch. But December of 1978, that was the last time Jack Kirby drew for Marvel. It was the last time he had new work that he had created for comics through Marvel. And in our next episode, we'll talk about what the comic work he did through the 80s and the animation stuff he did and some of the other stuff he did. But December 1978 was the end of Jack Kirby being a monthly comic book artist who was drawing tons of pages every month. He was done. He had started his career working in comics in the 30s, and in December of 1978, it was over. I'd like to thank you for listening. As I said, this was the time period where I met Jack Kirby through his art. And even though Kirby's second tenure at Marvel's sales weren't what they expected, and it certainly wasn't what Jack expected, one of the things you can look at is how many of his ideas were used by Marvel again and again and again and again, and how they went back and used his stuff. As soon as he left Marvel, Roy Thomas started on a very long story in Thor to integrate the Eternals into Marvel continuity. And at the time, there was actually some talk that, oh, the Eternals, there's no way they'll fit Marvel continuity because they have a completely different origin for the human race than Marvel does. They've got all this stuff. It won't fit. Roy Thomas actually did like a 14-part story that also involved Wagner's Ring Saga, of all things, leading up to Thor 300 and 301 by Mark Gruenwald, that actually wrapped up the story of the Celestials. So that was like immediately after Kirby left. Boom! They're using his stuff. While Machine Man was canceled, a few months later, maybe even a year later, it's back, written by Tom DeFalco and drawn by, of all people, Steve Ditko. So Kirby created the idea, it goes canceled for a while. When Ditko comes back to Marvel, they say, here, do this Jack Kirby character. And it's funny to me how well Ditko fit on the book, because Ditko and Kirby's styles were so different. But Ditko was able to do Machine Man very well. I already talked about how a lot of the stuff that Kirby created in Captain America got fed into the other books, got absorbed in. A lot of Kirby stuff from this time has resurfaced. Even his Black Panther, which people thought was so weird and so bizarre and so out of it didn't fit the character. In the 90s, when Black Panther had his own series through Marvel Knights, Jim Owsley, or Christopher Priest, however you know him as, most people know him now as Christopher Priest, used the Kirby ideas in his Jack Kirby, in his Black Panther story, as well as the Don McGregor ideas. So, the other thing about Kirby's work at Marvel in the 70s is it's all been reprinted except for 2001. All of it. Reprinted multiple times. In omnibuses, in trade paperbacks, in hardcovers. And it sells every time. I doubt there are other books that have been collected that sell that well, except maybe the X-Men. There is one last project I'd like to talk about, but it was kind of an unofficial project because it was never printed during Kirby's tenure at Marvel. Marvel had kind of bounced around the idea for doing a comic book adaptation of the British series The Prisoner. The Prisoner was a BBC series that lasted 17 episodes and was... It was never a huge success, but it was a cult hit. And Marvel had tried a couple of times to try and put together a comic of it. Steve Englehart had tried, a couple of other people had tried, and when Kirby came in, they gave him the idea, and Kirby drew a first issue, wrote and drew a first issue. And if you use nefarious means around the internet, you can find it. You can find the photocopy of Kirby's penciled and partially inked attempt at The Prisoner. And if you think The Prisoner, which is very much a psychological experiment in a lot of ways, it was kind of a spy series, but it was more a very surreal TV series set in a place called The Village, where retired spies go that they don't want out in the outside world, and the main character, number 6, is trying to escape from The Village in every episode. And Kirby did an issue, and it's fascinating to see Kirby's style mixed with the British psychological spy drama that was The Prisoner. And I don't think it would have sold, because The Prisoner was never something that sold, you know, tons and tons of copies. It was never a huge success, but it's always been a kind of a cult hit. But as I read it, I really wished I could have seen more. Kirby's interpretation of the series was just as fascinating and just as interesting and just as unique as his interpretation of the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey. So while it wasn't ever published, you can get your hands on it. The next episode I do about Jack Kirby, as I said, we'll talk about his work in animation, his work for smaller publishers, his return to DC, and then the projects that were done based on some of the concepts and characters that he created but didn't really have a chance to draw. I want to thank you for listening, and I want to thank you for listening to the ads, which are right now. Pretty much every form of entertainment has advertising, and this one is no different. Our first ad is for DreamHost.com. DreamHost.com is the best web host in the whole known universe. I've been using them for 14 years. They've always been able to help. They have great services. If you need a web page, they are the best. Just go to DreamHost.com, and if you use the code CRAZY, that's K-R-A-Y-Z, you get $20 off your first year. Our second advertiser is Graze.com. Graze.com is healthy snacks delivered right to your door, so that when you're at work, you can avoid the vending machine. When you're home, you don't have to reach for the bag of chips. It's dried fruit. It's new ideas. I get it every 2 weeks, but you could get it more often. Great food at a great price. And if you use the reward code CORYS3R5P, your first and fifth boxes are free. That's CORYS3R5P. And if you're listening to this here podcast, you're one of the most good-looking people on the internet, and you don't want to trust your skin to just any old razor, so shave with the amazing razors you get from Dollar Shave Club. Every month, they send a box with your shave supplies at the beginning of the week, or whenever you want. You can pop in a fresh blade and get that fresh blade shave. It feels fantastic, and it's just one of the many ways that you can maintain the good looks that everyone has come to expect from you. That's Dollar Shave Club. If you go to dollarshaveclub.com/crazy, it kicks a little back. All of these advertisers, they kick a little back to us, so we can wet our beak a little. We're not asking for much. We're not asking you for money. But if you need these things, go to our advertisers. They support this podcast. Thanks. The next episode I'm going to be doing, well, I don't know. Might be an interview. Might be the next part of Kirby. Might be Tales from the Crypt number 2. Might be Mad, where I go through the history of Mad the comic book. There's so many things I want to do, but there's one I need your help with. I've done episodes where I ask people for a treasured childhood memory. I've asked people what they miss. I'm asking you, the listener, what do you wish people knew about you? Just go ahead. You can email me at corey.strode@gmail.com and say, just in the header line, put, what do I wish people knew about me? You could call the phone line, which I mentioned in the plugs. You can private message me on Facebook. But I really want to know, what do you wish people knew about you? And yes, it's an open-ended question. Your answer can be funny. It can be touching. It can be where you really sort of bare your soul. It could be where you're being snotty and sarcastic. Doesn't matter. I want to know, what do you wish people knew about you? Thank you again for listening, and I'll be back next week. That's right. It's the summer of Solitaire Rose. I'll be back next week with more stories.